This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Konya.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. Today, I am very excited about our episode because we are talking to a guy who has a job that is not only cool, it is super cold, both for what it is and for where he's studying it.
Oh, I think you're giving us a hint there, Jeff. What problem are we solving today?
Why do we study alien ice?
Why do we study alien ice? Oh, now I understand why you're so excited about this episode. Who is our guest?
I knew you'd figure it out right away. Our guest is the very cool Dr. Will Grundy, planetary scientist at Lowell Observatory.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Will.
Hello, all. It's great to be with you.
We are thrilled to have you with us, and you get to study space and all of the different things in it. So can you tell us a little bit specifically what you study?
So I'm mostly interested in the outer objects in our solar system, the places where it's far away from the sun and super duper cold, places like Pluto and the icy satellites of the giant planets.
Wow.
Okay. So you just mentioned the outer solar system. I know a lot of our listeners are learning that there is that third zone out there now called the Kuiper Belt. One question I've always wondered, how many Kuiper Belt objects are there? And obviously that's going to be an estimate. I don't think you've counted them, Dr. Will. And how many of them are rock versus how many of them are ice?
So we've only discovered a few thousand.
Oh, okay.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. There's tons more out there. It's been estimated that the surface area of objects that are maybe around 100 miles or bigger in size in the Kuiper Belt exceeds the surface area of all of the solid bodies in the rest of the solar system. So, you know, Earth, Venus, Mars, all the icy satellites adds up to less surface area than what's out in the Kuiper Belt. So this is not a small region. If you like alien exotic geology, there's a lot of it out there.
Holy cow. Can you give us an estimate? Because maybe some people don't know. How far is the Kuiper Belt from us?
So traditionally, the Kuiper Belt is the region beyond Neptune. And sometimes people call them trans-Neptunian objects instead of Kuiper Belt objects.
Right.
I might use those terms interchangeably on you. So the measuring stick for the solar system is the Earth-Sun separation, and that's called an astronomical unit. That's 1 AU, 93 million miles. And Neptune is at 30 AU, so 30 times as far from the sun as Earth is. And the Kuiper Belt continues on out to maybe around 50 or so, with a straggling tail that extends much, much even further than that. So the solar system's a big place. And the region with the giant planets, Jupiter's at about 5 AU out to Neptune at 30. So that's kind of the middle zone from my point of view. And then the Kuiper Belt extends that far again.
Okay.
That's a lot. That's huge.
And that is very far away, like I mentioned in the intro. Can you tell us what types of telescopes or instruments you're using to study that far away?
Sure. Anything you can get your hands on, you use, right? So if you can get time on the Hubble Space Telescope, you go. If you can get time on James Webb Space Telescope, you go for it. You can also use ground-based telescopes. And because it's in our solar system, you can send spacecraft out there. And so the New Horizons spacecraft that sent back those fabulous pictures of Pluto, I guess 6-7 years ago now, you know, it took a decade to get out to the outer solar system.
Right.
It's a long trip, but you can do that in our solar system.
Sure. I want to follow up with one. You did mention ground-based telescopes. I do amateur astronomy with an 8-inch telescope.
Yeah.
I know I'm not seeing a Kuiper Belt object in my backyard.
Well, you might be able to. I mean, Pluto was discovered with a 12-inch telescope? 13-inch?
Wow.
Okay, so I was going to say, how big does a telescope on the ground need to be to start seeing one? And then how big are the ones that you're using to actually study?
Yeah. Bigger is better, of course, because the photons, the particles of light that you're looking at, they have to originate at the sun. They go out to the Kuiper Belt, which is a long distance.
Yes.
Right.
And then they reflect off the surface of some small body out there. And then they have to come all the way back in to where we can see them. Wow. And so it's like trying to catch a handful of raindrops when it's barely raining at all. You know, the bigger the bucket you got, the more raindrops you're going to catch.
Okay.
So the biggest telescopes in the world are the best ones for this purpose. And these are things like the 10-meter Keck telescopes out on Hawaii. And there's a very large European telescopes down in Chile and so on.
Okay.
So I've been reading a little bit about telescopes. Can you explain to our listeners the difference between what you see on, from a ground-based telescope versus the Hubble? Like, talk about the atmosphere and how that affects what you see.
Yeah. So there's the atmosphere is interfering with what you're seeing in two distinct ways. One is that it ripples and shimmers and so on. And so it just distorts the image that you see. And astronomers call that seeing and moan and groan about it a lot. but the other is that the atmosphere absorbs certain wavelengths of light. And especially there are very diagnostic wavelengths of light out in the infrared and in the ultraviolet and so on that you just can't see through the atmosphere at all. It's totally opaque. So it's, you know, it's like if you had your telescope at the bottom of a swimming pool and you were trying to look up through the ripples on the surface of the swimming pool and, you know, the water is absorbing light and so on. So that's what you win by getting up to low Earth orbit or L2, where James Webb Space Telescope is going to be located.
So we're going to get a really good view, hopefully, of some amazing far out stuff in space from the James Webb.
Exactly. And you'll also see at wavelengths that tell us, so different wavelengths tell you about different compositional information. And as a person who studies materials, I'm super interested in some of these wavelengths that you can't see through the Earth's atmosphere. So I'm very excited about what James Webb is going to reveal.
That's so cool.
Okay. So I want to jump deeper. We started with some easy questions. What you were just discussing, we are getting information from the light that we see. You're studying objects at the edge of our solar system in the Kuiper Belt. What kinds of information are you getting from the light reflecting off those objects?
Right. You'd be amazed how much information you can get from the light reflected off of distant objects. You can learn what it's made out of. You can learn about its texture, its temperature.
Its texture?
Its texture, even. Yeah. Like, so the particle sizes, for instance. I could make an analogy for you. I mean, the human eye is really tuned to, if you look at a piece of fruit, say, you can tell if it's moldy or if it's ripe or if it's underripe just by looking at it. You know, you don't have to touch it. You don't have to smell it. You can tell. And that's because the wavelengths that your eye is sensitive to are tuned to your needs or your ancestors' needs.
Right.
We use different wavelengths of light to look out at the, at, you know, astronomical targets or out in the outer solar system. And we can choose the wavelengths to give us all of these sensitivity to all the various ingredients that are out there.
That's a great analogy. I've never thought about it that way.
That is. Okay. So you study alien ice. Like, what can we learn from that? And why is it important to understand what's out there?
Yeah, let's start by just saying what we mean by alien ice. So everybody's familiar with water ice, you know, which is what you get when you freeze water solid. That's familiar territory. But all kinds of materials can freeze solid. And anything that freezes solid at a much lower temperature might be a solid out in the outer solar system and a gas at the temperatures that we're used to or a liquid.
Okay.
So an example is nitrogen, which is the main ingredient of the air that we're breathing. You get that cold enough and it turns into a liquid, and you get it even colder and it freezes solid. Another example would be methane, which is the gas that's burned in a stove or in a furnace powering a house, heating a house, that'll turn into a liquid and eventually it'll turn cold. And it just so happens that both of those ingredients exist on the surface of Pluto. And we know that from infrared spectroscopy. What we don't know so much about is how those ices behave as materials.
Oh.
And it's absolutely critical to what kind of geology you're going to get, what the materials are on a planet's surface. The materials that are able to change state, change phase, so go from solid to liquid to gas and back again, those are the ones that totally drive the geology. So think about Earth.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Just think about the moon. So if you just had a bunch of rocks.
Okay.
You'll occasionally get an impact crater. Boom. Yes. Blow a big hole in the ground.
Yes.
And maybe that's it. So maybe you'll end up with a sphere that's covered with pockmarks.
Okay.
That's not that exciting. But if you look at the Earth, there's a lot more going on. And the reason is that there's water, and the water can go into gas and it can freeze solid.
Yes.
And what that enables is the power of the sunlight, which is quite high power. We get over 1,000 watts per square meter at Earth from the sun. That's like 2 horsepower per square meter.
That's
so
crazy.
If you think about like a little Briggs & Stratton lawnmower engine, that's about 2 horsepower, right?
Yeah.
And that'll do a lot of damage on a square meter if you've got it hooked to a drill or, or a plow or something. That's how much energy is arriving at the Earth's surface. But what enables that energy to shape the Earth's surface is a material that can change phase. So water can evaporate from the, powered by sunlight, evaporate from the ocean, and then condense as rain up in the mountains and run back downhill and create rivers that carve channels. And, you know, I live in Arizona, and there's the Grand Canyon, you know, just a little to the north out this window.
Yes.
That's a pretty impressive testament to what kind of carving action water
erosion
can do.
Erosion over many, many, many years. Millions.
Yeah.
Millions.
Well, just millions.
Millions.
It's pretty fast. And, you know, if you live on the coast and you've seen the kind of coastal erosion that wave power can do, it's the same thing. Or if you live in a, you know, high latitudes and you've seen the valleys carved by glaciers, they're totally different than the valleys that are in shape than the valleys that are carved by rivers, because it's carved by water in the solid state instead of water in the liquid state. But that's just Earth, where we have one material that can change phases.
Right.
And on Mars, we have two materials that can do that. There's both water and carbon dioxide, both of which are freezing solid on the poles and moving around in the atmosphere, and you know, sunlight mobilizes them, and they're totally shaping the surface of Mars. And you go further out in the solar system, and by the time you get to Pluto, there's nitrogen, you know, from the air that we're breathing, carbon monoxide, which you would not want to breathe if you could help it, and methane. And all three of those things can freeze solid on the surface and evaporate up or sublimate up into the atmosphere and move around the planet surface and, you know, carve geology and do all kinds of crazy things. So that's why I'm interested in those materials, because I want to understand what kind of geology they're going to do for me.
Okay. So exactly what you were just describing with Pluto. I'm a big Pluto fan and New Horizons fan. And Dr. Will, I know you were part of the New Horizons team. I'm picturing, and the listeners will put this photo on our website, there is a picture from New Horizons of Pluto that shows both mountains and glaciers in the same photograph. Are those features on Pluto being carved by what you're talking about right now?
Yeah, absolutely. There's glaciers that are mostly nitrogen ice, but with a little bit of methane and carbon monoxide in them. And even though the power of sunlight is much, much, much weaker on Pluto than it is on Earth, because it's just so far from the sun, it's still enough power to mobilize them. And, you know, we've got time, geological time. You know, they'll condense somewhere else and they'll flow downhill and they'll carve these glacial valleys.
Wow.
And so it's a very dynamic environment. The timescales are longer because it takes Pluto 2.5 centuries to go around the sun once, like it takes Earth 1 year to go around the sun.
Well, you know, it's incredible, because when you think of how the Earth has been shaped, of course, the first thing I think of is volcanoes, right? You know,
which is also another phase change thing.
Right.
So, you know, if you can have rock that's able to melt from the, and now this is the heat from the interior of the Earth, which is tiny compared to the sunlight. So from sunlight, we get a little over 1,000 watts per square meter.
Right.
From the decay of radioactive materials deep inside the Earth, we get about 90 milliwatts per square meter.
Whoa.
So it's down by a pretty big factor, but even that's enough. So the 1,000+ watts, that's 2 horsepower.
Right.
And 90 milliwatts would work out to maybe 3 or 4 mouse powers. You know, so if you want to plow a square meter of land, you'll get there a lot faster with horses than with mice, but you'll get there.
Yes. But that is still enough to melt rock?
Yeah. Especially if the heat is having trouble escaping. And, you know, so there's some layer of somewhat insulative layer, and the heat just slowly builds up.
And then it gets hot enough so that it...
Something melts and it you know, you get your volcano.
Up it erupts and whatever.
Yeah. Oh. The other thing that happens in addition to volcanoes, if you think about Earth, is plate tectonics. And so you've got this slow motion convection. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. That's fair. That's geology that's doesn't require a phase change, I suppose.
True.
But it gets much more dramatic when there's volcanoes all along those plate boundaries.
Oh, sure.
And then, you know, oceans eroding the volcanoes. And
exactly. Yeah.
So I'd like to ask, Dr. Will, for you personally, being a planetary scientist, how did you get interested in trans-Neptunian objects, Kuiper Belt objects, rather than wanting to point your telescope at, say, Mars or Jupiter?
Really, there's two things that attracted me. One was the prospect that you could use spectroscopy to learn about something so far away that when I started, it was still just a point of light, really.
Right.
But you could learn about what the ingredients were, and then you could mix those up in the lab and play with them in the lab and see what they can do. And then the other thing was, you know, this dates me, but back in the 70s and 1980s, as the Voyager spacecraft were flying by one after another of the giant planets and revealing all of these amazing discoveries and worlds, and you'd see the press conferences, and those scientists were obviously having so much fun. I was like, well, gosh, I would like to do that, but there's only one left, so I guess I'll have to do that one.
Okay.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I remember those days. It was amazing. Okay, so if I'm looking through a telescope and I'm looking at Pluto and whatever, what am I seeing? Am I seeing colors? Is that what tells you the different temperatures? I mean, if you could just give us an image of, you know, an idea of what you're
looking
at.
You looked with your eye, you would see something that looked sort of the color of brown sugar or something.
Okay.
And what's coloring it is actually complicated organic molecules that are produced from the methane and nitrogen and so on that's there by space radiation.
Okay.
It's almost the same process as baking something in the oven, you know, where you're changing the chemistry of it and you're making some somewhat more complicated molecules. But your eye can't see out into the infrared where you can distinguish between methane and nitrogen and carbon monoxide and ethane and all of these other compounds.
Right.
You know, so, you know, after you appreciate it with your eye, the next thing you want to do is put an instrument on that telescope that can actually see these other wavelengths that your eye can't see.
Oh. And then are they different colors that tell you which gas is which, or how do you know?
Effectively, it's I mean, the eye is only sensitive to really three different kinds of color receptors.
Okay.
Unless you're colorblind, and then it's two.
Right.
And so a typical instrument that you would put on the telescope might be sensitive to 1,000 different colors or 10,000 different colors.
Oh, wow.
You know, so they're really, they go quite a ways beyond what the human eye can do. Basically, if you picture a rainbow,
right,
and the eye would put maybe three different, would group that into three different bins. And from those three different bins, your eye can reconstruct the colors of the whole rainbow.
Right. But
instead of putting three bins on there, we put 1,000 bins on there, you know, and slice it really finely.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing.
It really is. So staying out in the Kuiper Belt where you're doing your work right now, what are you, and I feel like this is a big question, what is it that you are trying to learn out there?
There's a bunch of things that you can learn from the Kuiper Belt. One is that this is a reservoir of objects that are left over from the formation of the planets. And so you can learn something about how the planet formation process works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also true of the asteroid belt, but in the asteroid belt, it's much closer to the sun and everything whoops around a lot faster. And so that when they crash into each other, the violence is a lot worse.
Okay.
Yes. So things in the asteroid belt are pretty beat up. That's nice if you want to see what they look like on the inside, because you'll probably find one that's smashed open. But if you want to see what they looked like right when they were made, go look out in the Kuiper Belt, because they're things that have suffered a lot less damage. Another thing is that, you know, there's Pluto out there, which is sort of a new class of planet, very distinct from the gas giants and very distinct from the terrestrial planets like the one we live on. And there's a whole bunch of them out there. So you can compare them to each other and you can learn a lot about how they work by just comparing different planets out there.
Okay.
As a planetary scientist, I don't get to build a planet to my specifications. I just got to take what nature built for me. But luckily, there's a whole bunch of them out there. And the process of comparing them and taking advantage of the experiments that nature ran for you is called comparative planetology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so if you're interested in the effect of how close they are to the sun, you could find some that are closer and some that are a little further away, and you can see how they differ. Or if you're interested in the effect of size, you can find a bigger one, a littler one, and, you know, try to map that out.
Can you tell us like something really cool that you've discovered by looking out in the Kuiper Belt?
Well, we've certainly learned a lot more about how Pluto works from, you know, the New Horizons data.
Right.
And we're still sifting through the data and trying to make sense of it. And that will probably continue, well, until there's another mission that sends us even more exciting data. Personally, a discovery that I made was from spectroscopy was discovering carbon dioxide ice on the moons of Uranus. And it's, again, one of these things that's able to change phase between gas and solid, so move around. So it's almost certainly influencing the geology on those moons, but we don't have really high resolution images. And so I'd really love to see, another spacecraft go out to Uranus and take some very high resolution images and see how that geology works.
Wow. That's got to be so amazing to be able to look out that far and see now, you know, based on how long you've been doing this and the technology in the beginning to what it's available now is like, wow.
I mean, the thing is, when you make a discovery like that, your first instinct is, oh, I screwed something up. So I had observed Triton, which is one of the moons of Neptune, and Ariel, which is one of the moons of Uranus, on the same night. You don't actually process the data until like a day or two later.
Right, sure.
And I'm processing the data and I see the CO2 absorption lines on Triton, and that's where they belong. You know, everybody knew that Triton had CO2 because that had been discovered a decade earlier.
Right.
And then I process the Ariel data and I see CO2 lines. And I was like, oh, I must have accidentally mixed in a couple of the Triton spectra with the Ariel spectra. So I'm going back carefully checking. And it's like, no, I didn't. Actually, that must mean there's CO2 on Ariel.
I mean, that's awesome.
Well, and I think all of our listeners, I'm imagining my 10-year-old daughter, I'm imagining all of our listeners can relate to exactly what you were just talking about of like, oh, I did this math problem wrong, or I got this answer wrong.
Right. It wasn't the answer I expected.
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
One last question I want to ask, I know we're getting towards our time, is just before we turned on the recording, you were talking about binary systems out in the Kuiper Belt of objects orbiting each other. Tell our listeners just a little bit about that and maybe how prevalent those might be out there.
So what Jeff's talking about is Kuiper Belt objects where there's two Kuiper Belt objects that are actually orbiting around each other. And then that binary pair is going around the sun on its leisurely 3-century orbit. The binary Kuiper Belt object might go around each other in just a few days or a few weeks or as much as a year or two in a few cases.
Okay.
And we now know of well over 100 of them. Anytime you can find binaries in a system, among any population, it gives you the opportunity to learn more about that population because the separation and the orbital period gives you the mass of the system. So it's a way to measure the mass remotely. And once you know the mass, now you know something physical about the system. If you can figure out its the sizes of the objects and you have the mass, you can figure out its density. So you can tell if it's made out of rock, which is very dense, or made out of ice. So a lot of the binary Kuiper Belt objects that we've seen are actually less dense than ice. So they must have a lot of empty space in them. You know, they're really quite fluffy. And as you go from smaller objects up to bigger objects, you see that the density slowly increases up to a density that's sort of intermediate between ice and rock. And so like Pluto, for instance, is probably roughly 50-50 mix of ice and rock.
Okay.
And so there's this transition from these little bitty objects that are half the density of ice, even though they're probably the same ingredients, mix of ice and rock, but 75% empty space.
Okay.
And then as they get bigger, their gravity gets stronger and they eventually compact themselves into a denser. And so what I'm trying to do with these binaries is get a decent enough sample that I can see that transition from a fluffy planetesimal that's basically just the way it formed to something that's differentiated into a full-fledged planet.
Wow. I'm just kind of blown away that you can know this much information about objects that are so far from us. I don't know.
It's cool.
Amazing. I keep saying amazing, but
modern instrumentation is great. I mean, these instruments that get put on these 8 and 10 meter telescopes are absolutely fabulous instruments. And they're, you know, they're really, every decade, there's better instruments coming online because they are benefiting from the march of technology.
Yes, absolutely. So we've come to that part in the show where we ask our guests to give our listeners a challenge. Do you have a challenge for our listeners?
Yeah, what I'd suggest playing with materials that do phase changes. And the obvious one is water, okay, because you can freeze it into ice in the freezer. But it's kind of more fun to play with the more exotic ones. So what I would suggest you do is get your parents to take you to the grocery store and buy some dry ice, which is frozen carbon dioxide.
Right.
And it's super duper cold. They won't sell it to kids. You have to be an adult to buy it, but you can do fun stuff with it. Just don't touch it because it's so cold that it'll, you know, it'll give you frostbite instantly. So don't do that. Move it around with tongs or put heavy gloves on or something. But one thing you could do is you can, if you put a little bit of dry ice in a plastic bottle and stretch a balloon over the top, as the dry ice warms up and turns back into gas, it'll fill up that balloon. And you might be impressed by how little the chips of dry ice that you need in order to fill up a balloon.
Okay.
It expands by almost a factor of 1,000 when it turns into gas.
1,000? Yeah. Wow. I did not know
it was
that
much. Do this outside.
Right. So maybe do it outside. Well, I mean, the worst thing that'll happen is the balloon will pop.
Right. Exactly.
Another thing that you could do is the interaction between these materials that can phase change and inert materials is what drives geology in a lot of exotic locations.
Okay.
Okay. So we talked about the water carving channels on Earth in the rocks, and the rocks are more or less inert, but the water can do things to them. So taking some of that dry ice and sprinkling something inert over it, like flour, and then let the dry ice sublimate and give it, you know, a half an hour or an hour or more, and then look and see what it's done to the surface of the flour on top of it.
Okay.
Oh, that's cool.
And you can try flipping it around the other way too. Put the dry ice on top of the flour and leave it like that for a while. And then when the dry ice is sublimated away, see what the surface of the flour looks like where it was. See if it's carved any little channels. See if it's done any interesting things.
Right, because the gas wouldn't only leave through the top of the dry ice. Right?
Yeah, it's got to get out somehow. Directions. So maybe it go out sideways or, you know, so you can make your own alien geology in your kitchen.
That sounds like fun. I can't wait to see what our listeners do.
That sounds awesome. Well, this has been a fantastic chat today. I've learned so much, Dr. Will. Thank you so much for being on Solve It for Kids.
Thank you, Dr. Will. So that was definitely a cool episode, and it is fascinating the amount of stuff that scientists are learning from ice and planetary bodies that far away.
Right? I mean, I cannot believe that you could just look at a spectrograph or an image and they know exactly what that planet is made of. And to compare it to the old images that they had when we were kids, or even when I was a kid. And now Pluto is this beautiful burst of color in the planet. It's amazing.
Pluto's main moon of Charon, the other moons that they located out there, other dwarf planets that they're finding out in the Kuiper Belt, and all of those other objects. And they are learning so much from the spectroscopy. And to know that those icy bodies are changing so much because they're made of ice. How cool was that? And that leads us right into Dr. Will's challenge. I love using dry ice at my museum. Jen, I know you've done it as well. But not all of our listeners and families know that you can go to the local grocery store, safely and carefully get a block of dry ice with a grown-up, and then come home and do your own experiments with it. Dr. Will even gave us one experiment I've never done with my students at the museum, which is to put an inert substance like flour or sugar on top of the dry ice just to see what happens. I can't wait to do that one.
Oh yeah, that sounds like so much fun. So if you guys get a chance to do this, take some pictures or leave us a comment on our website, which is solveitforkids.com, or tag us on our social media. We are at KidSolve at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We love comments. And also, don't forget, if you go to the website, we have book recommendations. So if you want to learn more about all of these cool science topics, go there and check out some of those books at your local library.
Sounds great. And because I love Dr. Will, if anybody does this challenge and posts it to our social media, I'm going to send you a copy of one of Dr. Will's books about Pluto and Lowell Observatory. And until we see you next time, I bet you won't look at ice the same way. This is
Solve It for Kids.